everybody here can easily understand.
Just because it's late doesn't mean we're done yet.
And the server, that's a penalty!
And the quarterback, you kidding me, coach?
There's plenty more hits to dish out.
Well, he really hit the shit out of that one, didn't he? Look at that, he hit the f***ing ball. That gets a free steak.
This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5. Presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph, Get Physical RX. Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology.
And by BetUS, the original online sports book.
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's Patrick Creighton. Look in my
eyes, what do you see? This is the only live, local, consistent evening sports radio show in the city of Houston. Late Hits, ESPN 97.5. Patrick Creighton with you. 713-780-3776, 713-780-ESPN. On the HRMP listener line, on the text line, on X, Twitter, at PCreighton1. Brian McDonald on the other side of the glass at the master controls, at Sack by BMAC on the X, Twitter. On the Twitch stream, twitch.tv/ESPN975. ESPN975.com, ESPN975 app. Tell Google, tell Alexa, play ESPN975. Take us with you everywhere you go. Yeah, you know you want to. We're going to get to plenty of stuff tonight. But as many of you who have listened to me for a long time know, this is the hardest day of the year for me. It's always the hardest day of the year for me. And there was a long time where I basically did not work on this day. I would just call out. I would deliberately schedule this as a vacation day. Some days it was so bad, like just the stress of it would cause me to have such horrible migraines. I would literally just turn off every light in my room, pull all the shades down, and pull a pillow over my head because the slightest bit of light would just sound like a gong in my head every time that I'm basically forced to relive 9/11. And there's a lot of people out there who, if you didn't live through that day or you weren't old enough to understand that day, you don't understand what that day is. You don't understand what 9/11 means. You think 9/11 is a meme. It happened in a different state, so it didn't matter. I wasn't old enough. Obviously, I wasn't born yet, December 7th, 1941. But both my grandparents wound up serving in World War II. My mom's father actually served in Japan in 1945. So I learned about it. I learned about it partly from books and partly from what I could learn from my grandfather, who never wanted to talk about it, literally until about a month before he died. When I was a kid, I had his army jacket. I wore his army jacket. He had brought home a Japanese rifle, took the firing pin out of it, so I was able to use it as a toy. But September 11th is a very difficult day for me. As many of you know, I used to work at 26 Broadway in Manhattan, right across from the Bull. If you've ever seen various shows, they take a picture of the Bull. That Bull is literally right there at 26 Broadway. And I worked at that building for several years, which was roughly, I don't know, 3 blocks from the Trade Center. I don't even think it's a full mile. And, you know, 9/11 was a Tuesday morning. There was nothing really special about it. It was a day that I didn't have to go into work real early because I was working for a customs clearing agent. And so basically as ships came into port, we cleared what they were bringing in and out through customs. If anybody was coming off the boat, we had to get them cleared through immigration. Customs and immigration were in the bottom of the South Tower. And I didn't have to go in early, so I was sitting in traffic, driving into Manhattan, extremely unusual traffic, when I got a phone call from my mom. And she's in a panic. And she says to me, a plane hit the World Trade Center. And I said, Mom, what do you mean a plane hit the World Trade Center? Planes don't fly over southern Manhattan. And this is something that you notice because my in-laws live on Long Island, and they live right in the flight pattern of JFK. So, especially on weekend nights, the international flights would all fly over their house, over their neighborhood, as they moved down across Long Island from the North Shore to the South Shore, down to JFK, because JFK was the international terminal, and LaGuardia was a domestic terminal. So when planes don't fly over your head, as somebody who grew up with planes flying over your head all the time, you notice. It's weird. There's no plane noise. You know, somebody who grew up going to games at Shea Stadium. Shea Stadium's right next to LaGuardia Airport. Every other inning, a plane would take off and fly right over the stadium. It was loud as hell. So when you didn't have the planes flying over, you noticed. It's like, planes don't fly over southern Manhattan. So when she said it was a plane, I thought, okay, maybe it was like a small plane. It was like a single engine, like personal craft. And she's like, no. It was like an airliner. And I'm like, there's no way an airliner was flying by the Battery Tunnel. It just it never, there's no way. And then a second plane hit. And there's not a lot of footage of the first plane hitting because nobody knew to look for it. But the second plane, everybody was looking for because all the cameras were focused on the first tower. And you saw the second plane hit. When the second plane hit, it deliberately dove down to hit the tower further down towards the middle because it saw the first tower still standing from where the first plane hit. And at that point, if you didn't know, you knew we were under attack. Manhattan was closed. Tunnels, bridges, everything. It was closed. South of Midtown, the whole city was on lockdown. I have a lot of friends who are NYPD, who are FDNY, who are EMS. Every one of them was now rushing to the Trade Center. There were massive flames coming out of the buildings. You know, hundreds and hundreds of gallons of jet fuel burning so hot it's making the steel beams melt. People on the top floors having to make decisions if they were going to jump to their deaths or let themselves be consumed by flames. Emergency services workers contacting people on the higher floors telling them, we're going to come up and get you. Stay calm. Where both sides knew there was no way up there. A lot of people got called to be heroes that day. This is a really hard day for me. And I'm sorry that I'm going to get a little bit choked up because, like I said, it's very difficult for me to even watch the 9/11 memorials because it makes the memory come back so strong. It's like I can still smell the burning. A lot of people didn't get to come home that day. Regular, just husbands, wives, kids. Cops, firemen, EMS. People who chose willingly to go inside burning buildings that they knew were going to fall down to try to get as many people out as they could. Knowing what the end result was going to be. Like I said, I worked a couple of blocks from the towers, and I knew a lot of people who didn't come home. My father worked in Tower 7, and originally, after the second plane hit, they were told they were going to shelter in place, but local security decided they weren't going to do that. They were going to evacuate them. The first shelter-in-place order came after the first plane hit. And then when the second plane hit and it was a confirmed shelter-in-place, the slight evacuations became a mass evacuation. And it's a good thing they did because if they hadn't, everybody in that tower would also be dead. I was very fortunate. My father was able to come home. Most people didn't get to have their family come home. They worked in those buildings. They didn't get to say goodbye. Later on, we would learn that there was another plane that was hijacked that crashed into the Pentagon. There was another plane that was hijacked that was crashed into a field when passengers on the plane found out what was going on, found out it was a hijack, and they fought back. Neil Young wrote a song about it called Let's Roll. Today, there is one tower that stands where two towers used to be. There's a memorial at its feet for all the people who never came home from work on September 11th, 2001. And in the aftermath of that tragic event, something incredible happened. People of the biggest city in this country, men, women, white, black, red, yellow, didn't matter what you are, your race, your ancestry, your heritage, what language you spoke, none of that mattered. Gay, straight, bi, tri, that didn't matter. The only thing that mattered was everyone working together, digging through the rubble, rubble that they told us would pose no threat to us when we would later on learn out it was in a highly toxic environment. But people of all backgrounds, all diversities, all ages, all races came together and worked for a common goal, and that was to hopefully find any possible survivors and identify those who didn't. Nobody cared where you came from. Nobody cared what part of the city you were from, what country you came from, how tall you were, how dark your skin was. Nobody gave a damn. We just worked together as people. And if there's one thing that we can take from September 11th, it's knowing that we can work together regardless of our differences. And I hope that one day we can do that every day. Late Hits.
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Sweet Sassy Molassie.
Sweet Sassy Molassie. Get out the checkbook and pay grandma for the rubdown as the Spurs beat the Heat.
Late night Houston sports talk only happens here. It's Late Hits with Patrick Creighton. Presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph. Get Physical RX. Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology.
And by BetUS, the original online sportsbook.
From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
Hey guys, let me tell you about my favorite sportsbook and casino. It's BetUS.com. You know, look, there's no better time to make your money than during football season. What's better than watching football and getting paid? It is literally the second best way you can possibly make money. Now, I only endorse one sportsbook casino. It's BetUS.com. And for their 30th anniversary, that's right, 30 years of being a sports betting service, for their 30th anniversary, they are offering up to 30 risk-free bets. That's right, 30 risk-free bets. It's called Bet Protect. They also offer the industry's biggest sign-up bonus at 125%. And if you sign up with crypto, that industry-leading bonus will actually improve to 200%. Not only can you get huge bonuses and bet protect with BetUS.com, but you know you can keep that excitement going all game long with live in-game betting. So take advantage of this 30th anniversary offer. 30 risk-free bets. Get bet protect. Get started today. Visit BetUS.com. Or call them 1-800-MY-BET-US, 1-800-MY-BET-US. Learn about all the bonuses, all the special offers, 1-800-MY-BET-US, BETUS.com, sportsbook and casino, where the game begins. Now, we had NFL football this weekend, finally, finally, games that mattered. And, you know, there are a lot of crazy things that happen. Some of these games wound up being a lot closer than maybe anybody thought they would. Some of them wound up with teams winning that we thought had no chance of winning. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way for the Texans. We all thought the Texans were going to lose, and they absolutely lost. They were outmanned, outgunned, and outclassed from the very beginning. But, you know, B-Mac, we talked about this game last week. I said, you know, here, be competitive for a half before the Ravens start pulling away. And the reality is, outside of the third quarter, when the offensive line suddenly couldn't block me, you, and a couple of fourth graders, the Texans battled the Ravens pretty evenly for three of the four quarters yesterday, which is probably a little on the high side of what we could have expected. The offensive yards gained, the Texans actually outgained the Ravens. They gained more yards. Both teams got flagged a million times. It was flag fest. This was ref show all day. The Texans were flagged 9 times, like 88 yards. And the Ravens were flagged 13 times for over 100 yards. You couldn't go from the start of this segment to now without a flag being thrown. It was ridiculous, the amount of flags that were getting thrown. And the Texans also had a really bad habit of, well, it seemed like every time they would make a really nice play, wait, we've got a flag on the play. And it was always against the dang Texans. There were a couple of pass interference penalties that I think were dubious. Particularly that the first one where the Texas defender had inside position on OBJ on an absolute duck of a pass that was probably 7-8 yards away from where they were. So Odell Beckham tried to run through the defender to get to the ball. And because, quote, the defender obstructed his route, that was called a pass interference.
Yeah, that was one of those classic examples of where the pass was what caused the interference, not the actual contact from the defensive back. The defensive back couldn't do anything about it. It's one of those things you wish wasn't in the game, but it's never going to be taken out of the game. If sometimes a bad throw causes the pass interference, and that was one of those cases.
Look, it's just bad interpretation by the official. The official can clearly see the pass is nowhere near them. It cannot be interference for the defender doing their job and having underneath what he's supposed to stop. The defender is supposed to say, oh, excuse me, Mr. Wide Receiver, the ball is a terrible pass. Why don't I just let you run right by me and get to it?
Yeah, it's one of those things that shouldn't exist, but it does. It's kind of like the rule in basketball where the defender is supposed to own his space from the floor to the ceiling. So if you jump straight up, you're supposed to not ever be called for a foul if someone's driving into the hoop on you, but you're called for a foul every single time. It's, what is actually written in the rule book is just not the way that the leagues have chosen to interpret it. So it's, I mean, we've seen it for years. We're going to see it we'll see it to the day you and I both pass on from this earth and go to the next one. We'll probably see it in the next world if they have NFL football. If the pass is poorly thrown and the defensive back just happens to be in the wrong spot, they're going to throw it every time.
You know, the one on Stingley going down the sideline, OBJ was never catching that ball either. And look, nobody has seen more OBJ highlight catches than I have, Giants fan. But the ball wasn't catchable. OBJ kind of flopped. And, oh, flag. Why? Because he flopped. That was it, because he flopped.
It also might be a week one thing. We've seen this in the past where week one, the refs get really ticky-tacky and call everything by, like, the strictest definition of every rule just to kind of wake everybody up and let them make sure everyone knows what they're supposed to be doing. And then as the season goes on, starts to get a little bit looser. They start to let the players play a little bit more. So not to make an excuses for the ref, but that might have been what happened. Because you mentioned it. What, 9 penalties for the Texans, 13 for the Ravens? That's not a normal game. If this game was played in November, I don't think all those flags get thrown.
No, 22 flags in a game is ridiculous. It is flat out ridiculous. And it often ruined the flow of the game. Then, of course, there was the fourth down where the referee blows the whistle because the Texans made a substitution. The Ravens didn't make a substitution, so the ref blew the whistle because they didn't make a substitution.
Yeah, that was very bizarre. I mean, it took me a second to realize what was happening when I watched that play. I mean, it certainly gave, at the very least, the Ravens a free chance to look at the Texans' formation and then make a better determination as to what they wanted to call, because they got a free look at it with the referee blowing it dead. There was no reason for him to blow the dead. It looked like it was preseason for the refs at times out there as well.
And why should the officials ever not be preseason for them? But there were, I thought there were a lot of good things for the Texans. I thought that Damian Pierce ran hard despite the fact there wasn't a lot of room for him to run.
Yeah, he looks, it's hard. When you're in a negative game script and you're down like 9-10 points, you know, pretty much the entire second half, you're not going to hand the ball off a whole lot, especially with as good as Damian Pierce is. He's not someone like, name any super quick running back, but he's not going to house it from 80 yards out. So in a negative game script like that, Damian Pierce isn't going to get the ball more than 11 times like he did in this game against the Ravens. But I thought in his limited work with a terrible offensive line from him, he still looked the part of an explosive running back, where if they have a lead and they have an offensive line like with Tytus Howard back that can actually get a push, I think Damian Pierce is going to look just as good this year as he did last year.
Well, the reality is, when you've got a rookie quarterback making his first ever start in the road, hostile environment against a really good team, it's a playoff team, you can't go, all right, we're just going to scratch the run and we're going to chuck it 44 times. Well, sorry, 49 times. He'd be sacked 5 times. You can't just abandon the run and let the Ravens, okay, we're just going to come pass rush, we're going to pin our ears back and come after you every single snap. Like, you can't, oh, well, it's week one, and quote, we're going to, quote, try to win. You're not winning if you don't have some kind of balance. They had no balance whatsoever.
I would agree in the first half, because certainly it was obviously still close in the first half. But once you get up, I kind of feel like it's either way, the Texans are wrong situation, because I know there's a lot of fans who would say, why didn't you run the ball more? Those same people, not you necessarily, but a lot of people would also, in that same situation, if you did run the ball a lot, being down 10 in the second half, like, why are you running the ball? You're losing. Like, we need to speed up this game. We can't afford to run the ball right now. So it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
Yeah, and I think that's very short-sighted on any fans who would say that. Look, you need to have some kind of running game to prevent the other team from just bum-rushing your quarterback when you know you're down 3 starters on your offensive line. You have to keep the defense honest, and they failed to do that. Now, here's D'Amico talking about, coaches were talking about what they discussed immediately after the game.
I think from an offensive perspective, as you can see, like, we can move the ball. All right, Poston, I thought CJ did a really good job of, you know, going through his progressions, putting the ball exactly where it needed to be. He did some really good things for us. And operationally, I think pre-snap, we can be better, just getting in and out of the huddle quicker, right, getting up to the line of scrimmage quicker. So, you know, when we snap it and we play ball, CJ can play with the best of them. So we just have to help. So we just help him speed that process up.
Hey, we got to help him. Having a running game would have helped. Having an offensive line actually pretending to block would have helped. Those would have been important things. Now, you mentioned, look, Damian Pierce had 11 carries, and he had 2 receptions. Damian Pierce was 13 times. Damian Pierce is arguably their best offensive playmaker.
Oh, I don't think there's an argument about that.
Your best playmaker has to touch the ball at least 20 times. Here's D'Amico talking about their need to involve Damian Pierce.
The value of running backs is very significant for me. If you want to be a good offense, I still think you have to be able to run the ball, right? If you become one-dimensional one way or the other, right? I think having a good running backs just allows you to be, you know, multi-dimensional when it comes to offense, and you can't just tee off knowing that it's pass, right? So having the good backs in this league is definitely an advantage, and running backs are high value for me.
I think that's D'Amico's way of saying, yeah, we need to get the ball to Damian Pierce more. This was something that Lovie Smith learned the hard way last year too, because the first game of the year, they primarily gave the ball to Rex Burkhead. For whatever reason, Lovie Smith decided they weren't going to give the ball to Damian Pierce because he's a rookie and, you know, he just hasn't earned it per se. And in the second game, they gave the ball to Damian Pierce a lot more often. Maybe Bobby Slowick needed to figure out how he was going to, how much of the game plan, maybe as Brian said, how much of the game plan was determined in the third quarter by, hey, we're down two touchdowns.
I also think, you know, the Ravens had some injuries in the secondary coming into the game. So I also wonder if that was a, maybe this is how we attack the Ravens defense. They're down in the secondary. Let's see if we can get at them early in the passing game. And if they start to maybe drop the safety back because we're beating them in the passing game, then we'll beat them with the run afterwards. And then obviously that didn't work, but then that translates into the second half when you're down and now you can't run the ball because you're down. So I think it might have snowballed on them. I mean, we saw, to me, when the Texans offense has looked the best, preseason included, was that second drive against the Dolphins in preseason game two. And that looked like a San Francisco offense, and Damian Pierce was heavily involved in that, and he was running the ball. And I think you will see that this week against the Colts because you're a home favorite, and home favorites run the ball more than road dogs. I mean, that's just the way the NFL usually works. When you're a home favorite, you run the ball more than when you're trying to go uphill on the road. So I think Damian Pierce, not only because he wasn't involved in this game plan, but because of the opponent this week, you're going to see upwards of 20 touches from Damian Pierce this week.
I need to see more of the ball in Damian Pierce's hands. I also need to not see Devin Singletary running between the tackles.
Yeah, that was
I need
weird.
To see Devin Singletary running the ball off tackle, end sweep, outside, throw him the ball in space, get him the ball in the flat. I need to see Devin Singletary getting the ball in space, not jammed up in the bottleneck. That's where Damian Pierce goes. If you're going to run the ball up the middle, you use Damian Pierce. If you want to throw the ball out into the flat, you want to run the little wheel route, you want to run that little button hook out 5 yards out, those are the things that Devin Singletary should be doing. So I think that they need to clean a few things up and be mindful of what is the personnel in the game for what is our play call going to be. Learning experience, like everybody is in their job for the first time. So there is a certain amount of learning experience to go around. We'll hear more from D'Amico on the other side. This is Late Hits.
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Pitter patter.
Well, pitter patter. Let's get at her.
Back to the Veritex Community Bank Studios. It's Late Hits with Patrick Creighton. Presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph. Get Physical RX, Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology.
And by BetUS, the original online sports book.
All right, we're going to give away some free stuff here in a second, but latest tweet from NFL insider Jordan Schultz. The fear is Aaron Rodgers is dealing with an Achilles injury. They don't know if it's ruptured. He's going to have an MRI on Monday. That sounds like Aaron Rodgers is done for the night.
Yeah, I'm looking at something that says the x-rays are negative, but the x-ray wouldn't show a tendon tear. So I just mean the bones are fine. But yeah, that Achilles injury, he would be not only done for this year, but at his age, he might be done.
That is an injury I've had twice. And I will tell you that when I first ruptured, the first time I ruptured my Achilles, I could not stand on it. I thought it was strange. Look, the play, look, it's early. You don't have to. I actually, first time I popped my Achilles was the bottom of a pile in a football game. I just heard a pop. I didn't even know it was me. And then all of a sudden I tried to get up and I went right back down. Aaron Rodgers was standing up after the play. And he was standing up and looking at the sideline. And then all of a sudden he decides to sit down on the field and roll up. It was very strange because generally if you rupture your Achilles, you're not standing.
Well, I would normally agree with you, except for I just saw J.K. Dobbins do it one day ago. Because when Dobbins, on the play that Dobbins, we eventually find out, tore his Achilles on, he popped right back up. Now, he was limping at first, but he popped back up and walked off the field on his own and eventually was helped to the locker room. But even then, when he was helped to the locker room, he had his arm around two people helping him, but it wasn't like he was even carted off at that point.
He's an alien. That's all. He's an alien.
Maybe so. Maybe that's what we found out yesterday. J.K. Dobbins has alien blood in him. But yeah, like when
he has two Achilles tendons in each foot.
But when Dobbins popped up, I thought, you know, just looking at the play, I was like, oh, he rolled his ankle. You know, maybe he misses the rest of this game. He's back next week, or at worst, is a high ankle sprain. He's out, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. But obviously, end up being much worse. But yeah, I don't know. I've never torn my Achilles. I tore my ACL, and
don't tear your Achilles.
I tore my ACL, and the same thing. I was able to, I mean, I heard it pop, and I was able to get up. And it, like, there must be an adrenaline thing that goes on in your body, because like the real like incapacitating pain and like the weakness in the leg didn't come till you know, like an hour or so later. Like I was able to, you know, walk away a little bit right after it happened. So it must be something to do with that.
But I tell you, that's for a team that thought it was going to have Super Bowl aspirations, certainly had aspirations of winning the AFC East. If Aaron Rodgers has a ruptured Achilles, their season's over.
Oh, yeah, without question. They'll be starting Zach Wilson for 16 more games.
Their season is over.
They'll be. They were, what, 7-10 last year? That would be their best case scenario at that point.
Yeah, I don't even. Not I don't with even Zach think- Wilson?
I mean, Zach Wilson was the starter last year, so.
Zach Wilson, they might, what are they going to win, 4 games?
I mean, they won 7 last year, maybe. I mean, that would be the absolute upside for them. But regardless if it's 7 or it's 4, they would have no shot at winning the division or making the playoffs.
Would you, if you were the Jets, would you trade for Jameis Winston?
I don't know. No,
would you try to bring Sam Darnold back?
Well, no, I think that ship has sailed. I don't think you could. A defensive coach like Saleh would never trade for a quarterback who turns it over as much as Jameis Winston.
Would you call up the Carolina Panthers for Matt Corral?
I mean, I guess everything would be on the table, because Zach Wilson would probably at that point be the worst starter in the league. But, I mean, insert any quarterback who's actually available, it's not going to be enough against the playoffs. It's like what we see. The Commanders maybe think they found a quarterback now with Sam Howell. Maybe they did, and I don't know. But you saw the Colts do this for years. The Commanders did it for years. You can swap the bottom, you know, the quarterbacks 25 through 32 in the league. It doesn't matter. They're all interchangeable once you get to that point in the QB depth chart around the league. It's not going to matter. It's not going to make a difference. The drop-off from Aaron Rodgers to Zach Wilson, Aaron Rodgers to whoever would be available in trade is going to have the same result. They're not going to make the playoffs.
Hey, is Jay Cutler available?
Now, that would be fun. Robert Saleh trying to inspire Jay Cutler, his bitter beer face, just not caring about anything. That would be fun.
Jay Cutler, the original ZFG quarterback.
Oh, man. Yeah, the memes of him with the cigarette hanging out of his mouth was just amazing.
Because, you know, finely tuned athletes are busy smoking cigarettes.
Yeah. I mean, having watched Hard Knocks, I could not see how Robert Saleh would deal with a guy like Jay Cutler. I mean, obviously he's not going there, but just hypothetically.
That would be quite the interesting.
Hey, maybe the Jets will call the Texans and offer a pick for Davis Mills.
I'll take a pick for Davis Mills.
Yeah.
Sure. I wouldn't bat an eye either. Sure, I'll take a pick for Davis Mills. I will absolutely take a pick for Davis Mills. I am 100% on that. All right, this was a decision that wound up having very large implications in the Texans-Ravens game. And this was when George Fant got injured. They made the decision to put Michael Dieter into the game. But instead of putting Dieter at left guard and moving Josh Jones from guard to tackle, because Jones by trade is a tackle, they decided to put Michael Dieter at right tackle. It was an epic disaster, because the very first play that Dieter was in the game for, defender runs around him like he's standing still. He was. And it winds up being a strip sack and a turnover on a play CJ had absolutely no chance in hell on, because the defender came completely clean around a tackle. He should have been blocked. He should have at least been pushed. But Dieter doesn't even get a hand on him. Here is D'Amico on keeping Josh Jones at left guard and putting Michael Dieter at right tackle.
Their offensive line, we've been shuffling guys a lot. As you guys know, we've had, you know, multiple injuries in the O-line, and we've had to shuffle guys. But in practice, our guys have moved around to multiple spots. Our guys played guard, played tackle. I thought Josh did a good job being his first time at guard. He hasn't been with us long, so being in a tough spot for him, you know, he accepted the challenge and he went out and he played good ball for us. So I'm happy with what Josh was able to do for us on Sunday.
Well, that's great that you were happy Josh played well at left guard, but what about Dieter at right tackle? Because, woof, I can live with Dieter at guard. I can't have Dieter playing tackle.
You were even underselling it, saying Dieter was standing still. I mean, I remember seeing the replay, and, I mean, the pass rusher was past Dieter before he was really even a stance to even attempt to block him. It was absurd.
If you didn't know better, you'd think Dieter didn't know the snap count.
Yeah, you really would. He was that far behind. I can't be mad at Dieter. He should have never been in that position to begin with. It was inexcusable for, I don't know if it was D'Amico or if it was Slowick that made that decision on that play to not make the change to put them in their more natural positions, but inexcusable.
Whoever did that should be placed in a burlap sack and beaten with reeds.
I think you've said that about too many things at this point. I'm beginning to wonder about your punishment techniques.
What? When we were incident, we were placed in a burlap sack and beaten with reeds.
Oh, was that an Austin? See, I didn't get that was an Austin Powers reference.
All right. Bad news. The Junk Grabbers are walloping the White Walkers 10-3 going to the bottom of the eighth.
Hold on. White Walkers are?
Toronto.
Okay, all right. Now I'm with you. All right,
continue. They're north of the wall.
Continue. Okay, I'm not a Game of Thrones guy, so you missed me on that one.
All right, the Astros are actually being one hit by the Athletics. They trail 2-0, bottom six.
Isn't that just? I mean, I've watched the Astros for a long time, and this feels like I'm having PTSD from back when I would have to hear Bagwell and Biggio after a game where they got dominated by some pitcher I haven't heard of.
Well, the Braves. Say,
talk about, oh, well, we just got to tip your cap. You know, just got to tip your cap. The pitcher was better today. But this feels like something we've dealt with as Astros fans for a long time where they'll hit around a guy like Chris Sale or someone that's actually decorated, and then they face somebody you've never heard of, some scrub, and for some reason they can't do anything against them. You say they're being one hit right now? What inning is it?
Bottom six.
See, I have the football game up, so I didn't even see what it was. But one hit right now through six. My God.
And the drug dealers and the coffee sippers are fresh underway.
Okay. Drug dealers. I know the coffee sippers are Seattle. Drug dealers.
The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim of okay. California.
See, of drug dealers are everywhere, so it's hard to pin that down
no,
to just
one
city.
No, they are the drug dealers. They were the team that was giving out fentanyl to their own pitcher. And
okay.
Him.
Okay. Okay. Now I'm with you.
Which, of course, nobody seems to get.
I need like a index card of all the nicknames to make sure I keep up with the conversation. Maybe I need like a play sheet on my wrist, like a quarterback. When you send in the signal of whichever team you're talking about, I can look down at my wrist and see, oh, Junk Grabbers, Arlington. Yeah. Okay, got it.
L.A. basically killed one of their own players. But, you know, fans around the league, hey, trash can! Because, you know, that's way worse than, you know, giving your players drugs so they die.
Obviously.
Or being the team that was dispersing the sticky stuff to every pitcher in the league. Because that guy who was doing it was an Angels clubhouse attendant who actually was going to court. He was being sued, prosecuted for that. So, yeah. In L.A., they do a lot of illicit things that apparently nobody cares about. I guess if they had made the sticky stuff and put it in a trash can, people would care. But I digress. So we'll get a look at what's going on with the Astros and the Athletics next.
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5, home of Odin Finch.
Odin Finch.
I'm Odin Finch.
This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5, presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph, Get Physical RX, Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology,
and by BetUS, the original online sports book.
From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
All right, how about some free stuff? Y'all like free stuff? I know I like free stuff. Shinedown is coming to Houston this fall with Papa Roach and Spirit Box. Shinedown, Papa Roach, and Spirit Box at the Cynthia Woods Mitchell Pavilion, Sunday, October 8th. Caller number 4, 713-780-3776. Caller number 4, 713-780-3776. Gets a pair of tickets to the show, Shinedown, Papa Roach, and Spirit Box. Get your tickets now at LiveNation.com. I would go to that show. Shinedown and Papa Roach, I would absolutely go to that show. I'd be all over that. Of course, I have a slight problem in that, well, the mother of children would have no interest in going to see that show at all, but I would go see that show in a heartbeat. I wouldn't even question it. I'm like, what? Yeah, oh, absolutely, 100% in. Now, the Astros only had to face Mason Miller for 2 innings because he was on a 50-pitch count. But we're in the top of the 7th. And, well, they're down 3-0. As Framber Valdez just gave up a solo homer to Shea Langeliers. And the Astros through 6 innings against Mason Miller and Ken Waldichuk, who entered this game with a 5.63 ERA and a 1.64 whip. Ken Waldichuk, 2-7 this year. They got one freaking hit. They got one freaking hit. Not only that, you look at the Astros lineup tonight. Is this essentially the best lineup that we're going to get on a regular basis because, you know, Maldian lineup? Altuve, Pena, Alvarez, Bregman, Tucker, Abreu, Brantley, Chaz, and Maldonado. Like this is probably the best regular lineup that does not include Yainer Diaz. And look, there's going to be a lot of games, especially in the postseason. There's going to be a lot of games. Don't include Yainer Diaz. Dusty gonna dusty. It is what it is. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that the Astros won last year on pitching and defense, and they scored enough runs to make it stick. That team is not this team. Right now, the Astros have a problem that pretty much every other team in baseball has. They don't have 5 starters. They have 3. Because Hunter Brown has been so bad. Forget, you know, is he going to be in the playoff rotation? He shouldn't be on the roster. Hunter Brown's command has basically abandoned him since June. And Friday night, his velocity was down. This is a guy who threw a career high in innings last year, then had the shortest offseason of his life, and now is throwing up career high in innings again. The whole idea of, quote, hitting the rookie wall, what that is it's where you've pitched more than you've ever pitched before, and now your arm is fatigued. I don't mean he's tired and he needs to skip a start. I mean his arm is fatigued. It is not, oh, I'm just physically tired and an extra day of rest will make me feel better. It's the kind of thing that you hope you could squeeze an extra month out of him after a 15-day. But in reality, he's pretty much done for the rest of the year. Like, what you're seeing from Hunter Brown is what you're going to see from him. We're a little too far in the season to expect, oh, he's just going to snap out of it. And continuing to throw your young pitcher, who is clearly fatigued, whose velocity is down, whose command is off, continuing to throw him is just going to expose him to higher risk of injury. Because what do guys do when things aren't working right? You make adjustments. You compensate. And when you start trying to compensate for things in your delivery, in your arm slot, that's how injuries happen. Since the dawn of baseball, that's how injuries happen. you're pretty much seeing the same thing here with Christian Javier, who always has that one inning he just can't get out of. Javier's velocity has been down all year. He's another guy where the command has sort of eluded him since June. Both he and Hunter have a tendency to leave pitches out over the middle of the plate, and they get hammered. Both of those guys really should probably be sitting down. The problem is they don't have the depth that they've had in past years to bring up other guys. And whether you want to say, look, you could bring up Ronel Blanco, who despite his kind of ugly numbers, Blanco has pretty much held his own for five innings with the Astros, surprisingly enough. Whether you want to bring up Sean Dubin, and look, Sean Dubin is a guy who once upon a time was considered an okay prospect in the Astros system. Last year, he was terrible. He was injured. This year, he's been highly inconsistent. He hasn't pitched a lot at the major league level. He's only pitched nine innings at the major league level, and they weren't a great nine innings. And he's been, you know, in Sugarland this year, too, where he's got an ERA of six. In 2021, he was their minor league pitcher of the year. He had 3.44 ERA at Sugarland and a 108 whip. He was really good. He struck out 69 guys in 49 and two-thirds. That's 12 and a half strikeouts per nine. Now compare that to this year, striking out 10 batters per nine, but walking five and a half from three and a half. Walks are way up, strikeouts are way down. Hits have gone from 6.5 to 8. His whip went from 108 to 151. All of a sudden, there's a ton of base runners on. And, you know, he's not 25 anymore. Now he's 27. He's not on the 40-man roster. But Spencer Arrighetti might be the best available pitcher at Sugarland right now. He's pitched decently. And he pitched pretty well for Corpus. And he's been okay. Keep in mind, the PCL is a hitter's league. Every ballpark is a launching pad. He's got a 4.37 ERA on a really mediocre Space Cowboys team. They're not that good.
I was going to say, I mean, I remember last year, to your point, Patrick, like Hunter Brown obviously led the PCL in ERA. His ERA was under three. Second place was over four.
Yes. He led the league in ERA by over a run.
Yeah. The second best ERA in the entire PCL was over four. And JP France is someone who we've obviously given a lot of flowers to over the course of the season. His ERA for most of his time in AAA has been over four.
It's...
So don't look at that.
It's a hitter's league.
Yeah, don't look at that four ERA and assume that person can't pitch. I mean, if it's up around six or seven, then assume they can't pitch. But just because it's above four doesn't mean that they're a bad pitcher.
No.
In the PCL.
In the PCL. In the PCL, you're looking for their whip. You're looking for their strikeout rate. You're looking to see the home run rate. Because if a guy keeps the ball in the park, in the PCL, he's got good stuff.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Reno, Las Vegas, El Paso,
Albuquerque. Albuquerque's a loser.
Albuquerque,
Fresno,
Salt Lake. I mean, they're all these ball. Basically, every ballpark except for Oklahoma City and Sugarland are just absolutely launching pads, and the stats don't mean anything.
Yeah, the Sugarland, I think, is the hardest park to hit homers at. And I will tell you this because I've seen it firsthand over the last several years. If the wind is blowing in from right, there is a jet stream to left. I remember calling a game for the Space Cowboys. I think it was last year.
Yeah, we did that game together.
It was last year where the wind was blowing in from right field, and Corey Jolks hit a ball out to left that went over the Bud Light Pavilion. It cleared the entire picnic area. He got it up in the jet stream, and that ball just kept going. That had to be a 460-foot home run. wind-aided, whatever. But that ball, he got that ball up in the air, and bye. It cleared everything. That is when even Constellation Field can be a homer park. But you've got to get the wind coming in. Now, it'll come in a lot, but not when it comes in straight from right field, left field to jet stream. Generally speaking, though, you hit the ball to right, that's a tough place to hit a home run. Hit the ball to center field, it's a tough place to hit a home run. So when you're talking about it from that aspect, and then you say, I mean, remember when the Astros, when Fresno was the Astros minor league affiliate? Right? In Fresno, everybody hit 30 bombs. You hit 30 bombs by accident. Guys who couldn't, you know, hit 160 for the Astros were hitting 30 bombs in Fresno. Everything went out. So, I mean, and look, Spencer Argus is not on the 40-man. He can't pitch in the postseason. But he can help you get through the regular season. Because whatever you're going to get from Spencer Argus is going to be better than what you're getting from Hunter Brown right now. It's going to be better than what you're getting from Christian Javier right now, who can barely get through four innings.
I mean, at least if you wanted to give one of these guys a fake IL stint, I mean, he could be the guy that you replace one of these guys in the rotation with, at the very least.
And that's the issue. Javier can't get through four innings anymore. Hunter Brown can't get through four innings. I mean, four innings are done.
And we got to get to break, but I think I came to the realization when I was doing the bullpen this last weekend, and I know it sounds like a crazy idea, but the more and more I talked about it, the more I talked myself into it. But I think obviously, Fromber and Verlander, you're 1-2, whatever order. I think it's pretty clear, although I'm a little worried that Dusty won't see it this way, that France is your 3 in the postseason. I'm worried that he might stick a veteran and keep Javier as a 3.
No, JP's got to be the 3.
I know, we say that, but what does Dusty say? I mean, the same guy that won't stop starting Maldi and for some reason hates Chaz, even though he brings in banana pudding and all that nonsense.
Allegedly. And look, here's the bottom line. Now, if I said to you, you've got to start game 4 of the ALCS, and you're up, let's say you're up 2-1, you need to start someone for game 4, and I say you could start Hunter Brown, Christian Javier, or Brandon Belak, who's your choice? Well, because if I tell you what my answer is, A, I'm going to hate myself.
Well, this is what I was getting to. I think you're forced into a triple piggyback situation. You can't trust Hunter Brown or Javier or Keedy or Belak now that we're throwing him into the mix, or Blanco, whoever it is. You can't trust them to get through multiple times through the lineup. We're talking basically one time through the lineup, 2 innings, on to the next guy. You use 3 guys to get through 6, and then you hand it over to the bullpen. I think that's what the Astros basically did that in 2017 with Charlie Morton and Lance McCullers at times, where they were splitting games. But obviously those guys, greater sign than what we're dealing with this year. So I've gotten to the point where I want Verlander, Fromber, game 1, game 2, France, game 3, game 4 is a triple piggyback. It sounds crazy, but I think that's the only way you get through game 4. You can't trust any of those guys to give you multiple times to the lineup.
I can't right now. I can't trust Javier or Brown to make it into the 5th.
Yeah, a triple piggyback. They don't have to. I'm talking 2 innings each.
I don't even know if I can get 2 shutout innings from them. Here, this stats that I'm going to give you are going to roll your mind. Next.
ESPN 97.5 on Twitch. We control the spice.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.